Amen. Well, I thought we would start with a game. I thought we'd start with a game that I'm calling Prime Minister Bingo. The goal is very simple. All that's going to happen is I am going to call out some dates in some years, and you, with the person next to you, all you have to do is work out who was the Prime Minister on that date and that year. You don't need to shout out. It's not a resignation speech outside Downing Street. The working title that I had for this was Pin the Prime Minister on the Year. It didn't quite scan, but I like the fact that it associated them with donkeys. So I'm going to start with an easy one. Who was the Prime Minister today, 5th of July 2026? If you'd like to talk with the person next to you. Yeah, this one is not a trick question. So even though he has resigned, he is technically still the Prime Minister. He is Sir Keir Starmer. He is our 6th Prime Minister in 10 years. I'm sure that's fine. All right, let's keep going. For our second one, who was the Prime Minister on the 5th of July 2016? 5th of July 2016. Okay, so this one was our marathon runner in this race. This is the one who's lasted the longest time in recent memory. This was David Cameron. 5th of July 2016, David Cameron. He lasted a whopping 6 years, which by today's standards is extraordinary. Okay, what about 5th of October? 5th of October 2022. So this one is the much maligned Elizabeth Truss. I liked the idea of doing 5th of July for each year, but for obvious reasons, that didn't work for Liz Truss. As James, I think, called out, she lasted slightly less time than a lettuce. Okay, and then last one is, who will be Prime Minister 5th of July 2027? So that one's a bit tricky, right? That one's a little bit tricky. I've heard Gareth Southgate, I've heard Jesus. And it's fun to joke about, but this kind of is the question, right? Like, if you've been following politics, you'll know that in theory, that's Andy Burnham. In reality, who knows? Who knows? And we're in this funny place at the moment where we can joke about that and be like, ha, 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 you know, 7th Prime Minister in 10 years. But actually, it is getting a little bit wobbly. Right? It is getting a little bit wobbly. The country we live in seems to have ground to a halt in its ability to make anything happen, but plenty of things keep happening to us. I looked up, over those 10 years where we've had 6 prime ministers, I looked up what percentage prices have gone up by. Over those 10 years where we have had 6 prime ministers, I looked at what percentage prices have gone up by. It is 42%. I'll give you a minute there just to calculate whether your pay has gone up by 42%. Students in the room, good news. That's, you know, your student loan is comparatively less, although you're getting less for your money as well. And on top of that, we keep hitting these large international crises, right? America is having this on-again, off-again war with Iran. We're getting heat waves, which are setting record temperatures and then breaking those records. We've got super intelligent AIs that are hacking governments and threatening to take your job. And if you needed any more evidence of the apocalypse coming, England is still in the World Cup. So how do we make sense of all of this? What are we supposed to do when the world doesn't seem to be working like it's meant to? When we are being told that we're accelerating towards life on a burning planet or death by robot? Well, today we're leaning into that question. And we're looking at our passage today. We're looking at Matthew 24 and the topic, how does it all end? What does Jesus have to say about the end of the world? And I noticed that they gave me this passage to preach on, and then all of the elders have left the building. So how does it all end? And to understand that, we need to go look at the rubble of a temple. So if you want to follow along, we're in Matthew 24. And if you've been following the speaker series, you'll know that for the past few chapters, Jesus has been visiting the temple in Jerusalem with his disciples. Now, the temple, as you'll know if you followed the speaker series, is not just like some old Greek temple. It is this very impressive set of buildings. It is the 10 Downing Street of the East. It is the White House of Jerusalem. It is the Jewish equivalent of Thomas Tuchel's dressing room. That's my second sports joke. I've got one more, and then I'm spent, right? For a nation that believes itself to be chosen by God, this is literally where God is. This is where the Holy of Holies is, where in the Old Testament faith, that's literally where you go to meet with God. It's the center of prophecy. If you think about the story of Israel, it's all centered around the temple. The key things happen at the temple. The Messiah is going to come to the temple. It's the place where once a year, one person, after a bunch of cleansing rituals, gets to go into the Holy of Holies and meet with God. So every year, there's this sense at the temple of like, what's God going to say this year? Is this going to be the year the Messiah comes back? And it's also the symbol of the health of the nation. If you think about the history of Israel and Jerusalem, when they get exiled, the temple gets taken away. And when they rebuild the temple, it's a sign that things are right again. So it's all of these really meaningful things to the Jewish people, and Jesus is walking away from it. And as he leaves, at the start of this chapter, the disciples motion towards the temple, as if to say, look at this amazing building. As if to say, why are we walking away from this? And Jesus says, not one stone here will be left on another. Every one will be thrown down. So for the Jews, the world was in the right place. The world was healthy. Everything was correct if God was in the temple and Israel was free. And here we are at the start of this chapter. The Messiah has come. Israel is not free, and the Messiah is talking about tearing the temple down. So this chapter is a story of the end of the world, as told by the one who was there at the beginning. And the question we're going to try and explore today is, how does it all end? So let's read the passage. Jesus left the temple and was walking away when his disciples came up to him to call his attention to its buildings. Do you see all these things? He asked. Truly I tell you, not one stone here will be left on another. Every one will be thrown down. As Jesus was sitting on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately. Tell us, they said, when will this happen? And what will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age? Jesus answered, watch out that no one deceives you. For many will come in my name, claiming, I am the Messiah, and will deceive many. You will hear of wars and rumors of wars, but see to it that you are not alarmed. Such things must happen, but the end is still to come. Nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom. There will be famines and earthquakes in various places. All these things are the beginning of birth pains. Then you will be handed over to be persecuted and put to death, and you will be hated by all nations because of me. At that time, many will turn away from the faith and will betray and hate each other. And many false prophets will appear and deceive many people. Because of the increase of wickedness, the love of most will grow cold, but the one who stands firm to the end will be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in the whole world as a testimony to all nations. And then the end will come. That feels like a good moment to have a drink. I think that what we just read is a list of things that are going to fail. And Jesus is listing one by one all of the things that you might think could save you. We all put our hope somewhere for what's going to give us a good life and a good future. Jesus goes through this list of things that you might believe in, and one by one, he just tears them down. So fittingly, given we're talking about prime ministers, Jesus starts with our leaders. I wonder who your Messiah is. Now, obviously, we're in church, it's a Sunday. We all know, right? We know who our Messiah is. But Messiah was a broad word. And when the people that Jesus was talking to heard that word, they would have heard it in a broad sense. Messiah is used throughout the Bible to mean the person who's going to deliver Israel. So the first king of Israel, King Saul, is described as a Messiah, the person who's going to deliver the nation, who's going to make everything right again. King David is described as a Messiah. At the time Jesus arrived, there were all of these local warlords around calling themselves the Messiah, the one who's going to deliver Israel. So I wonder, if I were to ask today, who would be your Messiah? Who is the person that you think, this person's going to make it all okay? This person's going to put the world to rights and is going to save our country. Jesus begins his description of the end of the world by saying that many will come in his name and deceive many. So at the end of the world, there will be false leaders, and they're not going to be enough to deliver us. So at the end, there will be leaders, but the leaders won't be enough to save you. But maybe you think, well, doesn't matter if the leaders are rubbish. We live in a great country. All of this suffering will happen somewhere else. We're nice and safe here. And Jesus' next description is that there will be wars and rumors of wars. Nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. In other words, the nations are going to fail. And when the nations fail, the way that they fail is in wars. They send their people to die for the sake of the nation rather than something else. And this is nothing new. We've seen this all the way back since the third human clobbered the fourth human over the head with a rock. War is constant, and war will be there at the end. So at the end, Jesus says, there will be nations, there will be countries, but the nations won't be enough to save you. Well, good riddance, you say. You're anti-nations anyway, or at least you will be after the World Cup. That's my third sports joke. That's it. That's all I've got, right? And maybe you think, well, there shouldn't be countries. Humanity should return into harmony with nature. When all the tyrants and the countries are gone, we'll live off the land and we'll be happy with our cholera. But Jesus says the land too is going to betray us. If you think about what we do with the earth, right? We put things in the soil so that we can feed ourselves. Jesus says that's going to fail. Famine is going to reject our work to sustain ourselves with the soil. And then what's the other thing we do with earth? Well, we dig it up and we build shelters and structures to protect ourselves from the elements. And Jesus says, well, earthquakes are going to come and they're going to knock down all of your structures. So at the end, there will be leaders, there will be countries, and there'll be nature. But nature won't be enough to save you. What Jesus is describing here is every effort that humanity has built failing with its last gasp to deliver us to paradise. Our leaders are false prophets. Our countries send us to die in wars. Our buildings fall down and our crops wither in the soil. But maybe you're thinking, no, Pete hasn't got me yet. I didn't believe in any of that stuff anyway. I believe in something else. Well, Jesus is still going. Jesus says the next thing that's going to fail you after your leaders, your nations, and your planet is your community, the other people that surround you. You will be hated by all nations because of me. You'll be persecuted and put to death. Okay, you think, that's fine. I've got the church. I'll go to a monastery. I'll be safe in the mountains somewhere. But when you get there, you'll find, Jesus says, many turning away from the faith and hating each other. And finally, perhaps, you will hide behind that ultimate declaration of, well, love wins. And Jesus says, the love of most will grow cold. So how does it all end? Not well. Not great. This has been a fun sermon so far. Our leaders deceive us. Our nations lead us to war. Our planet fails us. Our communities hate us. The church fractures. And the love of most grows cold. Jesus walks away from the temple, the seat of God on earth, the places that all of his disciples are expecting him to sit in judgment over everything and make everything right again, and says, not one stone here will be left on another. And this Sunday morning, I'm going to try and convince you that 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 is good news. Because I think it is. And I think it's good news because God is not in the temple. And as we talk about this, I'd like you to remember what Steve brought. The vision of Jesus from Daniel and Revelation. I think this is good news because God is not in the temple. So imagine, if you don't mind, imagine growing up in Old Testament Israel. We can pick one of the good times, right? You don't have to be in exile or like traipsing through the desert. You can just be like, you know, Dave the farmer, Dave the shepherd, right? Just pick one of the good times. Everything's fine. You've not been conquered. Let's imagine what it's like to live in that country. So you're part of a holy nation, a chosen people. You are one of God's chosen people. But your experience of that is that there is a temple several days' travel away. There is a temple several days' travel away, and God is in that temple. And if you want to have a conversation with God, you can somehow leave everything you own without it getting wrecked. You can travel to that temple, at which point, depending on who you were when you were born and how many sacrifices you can make, you can get maybe close to God. If you are the most privileged person in that country, you can, once a year, if you were born in the right tribe, you can go through a whole load of purification rituals, have a rope tied to your ankle, and you can go in to the Holy of Holies once a year, where you will go through this huge curtain and you will get to meet with God. The temple was this building that man had built for God. And in that temple, God had one room, in one building, in one temple, halfway around the world. Remember that picture that Steve shared of Jesus? And imagine him being happy in that one room. When Jesus dies on the cross, the curtain to that one room is torn top to bottom. Not so that everyone can walk into that room, but so that God can come out of that room and extend over the whole world. So I think this is good news because God is not in the temple. God is at a camp talking to people who've lost their children or had to deal with drug addiction. God is with you at 2 a.m. when you're worried about work the next day. God is here in a renovated church in Coventry when we sing to him. God is not in the temple, and so the temple gets taken down. So God is not in the temple, and God is not in the nation. We've had Christian countries. There are still plenty of them, right? There's grand churches, there's cathedrals, on the money, you know, in God we trust, and all those things. But ask yourself, what kind of nation would Jesus run? For a nation to exist, there needs to be a border. There needs to be an edge. There needs to be other nations. There needs to be a point where you stand at your border and you say, everything behind here is mine and everything over there is yours. All of the people on this side I care about and all the people on that side I don't care about. Can you imagine a world where Jesus, with his eyes like lightning and his voice like multitude, says, yeah, no, this is my little patch. And you carry on over there. In the end, God is too big for any nation. And so the nations are taken down. So God is not in the nation. God is not in the temple. And God is not in the earth. We grow food so we don't starve. We make shelters to protect ourselves from the elements. Both of those things are there to protect us against death. That's the point of them, right? We eat so we don't die. We build shelters so we don't die. That death no longer exists when Jesus comes back. Who's going to be the person that says, yeah, no, I will use the combine harvester in heaven? Who's going to be the person that says, I know God's over there, but I'm going to build a building over here so I can be inside it? God is not in the earth because what we do with the earth, we won't need when God comes back. And you can see where I'm going with this, right? I don't think I need to go through the whole list. Even when we get right to the end of that list and we're talking about people's love growing cold, God is bigger. Much though we might love each other, the love that God gives us is bigger. Our experience of community is a pale imitation of what God gives us through relationship with him. So God is not in the temple. God's not in the nation. God's not in the earth. God's not in the community, because God is bigger than that. And I think that's good news. If the return of Jesus and the restoration of the world still included passport queues and crop rotation, I think we'd all feel a little let down. So Jesus describes all of these failures, all of these structures that man has built falling over, as the birthing pains of something better. And that's important because it reminds us that none of this is accidental. This is not man finally getting comeuppance for all the fact that he can't build good things. This is the birthing pains of God's actual plan for something better coming along. It's all of our best efforts finally collapsing, but more importantly, it is Jesus' plan for his return to make way for the kingdom of God. So how does it all end? Well, it ends with the return of Jesus and the restoration of the world. There's just some stuff they have to clear away first. Okay, so what can we learn from this? What can we do on a Sunday morning about the end of the world? Well, the first thing I think is we can understand that God is not sentimental about the things that we build. God is not sentimental about the things that we build. We might expect, given that God had been present in this temple for a couple of thousand years on again and off again, we might expect that he might have grown to like the place. You know, he likes the way that that wall is colored, and he remembers the nice chat he had over there in the corner. We might expect that he'd kind of grown fond of the place. But what we see is actually the opposite. Jesus goes to the temple in Matthew and has a horrible time. Almost the first thing he does at the temple is get furious and go and attack a whole pile of people. He then argues with everyone and leaves and says the whole thing needs to be pulled down. What the temple has become by the time Jesus visits it is the opposite of what it should be. Instead of being a place that leads people to God, it has become a place that separates people from God, that prevents people meeting with God. The temple has always been too small for God, but now it's keeping people away from him, and so the temple has to go. Jesus walks away from the temple and says, not one stone will be left on top of another. I wonder how you feel about the church buildings in Coventry. I wonder how you feel about the Church of England and its large cathedrals covered in rainbow flags. I wonder how you feel when you see a beautiful stone church being converted into a mosque. Jesus reminds us here that God is not a building. His church is his people. And when a building has lost its purpose, we can see in this passage that God is not squeamish about tearing that building down. God is not in the temple. He's too big for that. Secondly, we can see how we are meant to prepare for the end of the world. The one who stands firm will be saved. When we talk about the end of the world in the apocalypse, what we tend to talk about is toilet paper. How am I going to be ready? Do I have enough baked beans? Do I have a bunker? What currency is going to be used? Do I need to start storing up bottle caps? Should I live in the city? Should I live in a town? How do I be ready for the end of the world? And Jesus wants us to be prepared as well. But he means something very different by being prepared. We're in Matthew 24 for this passage, but if you look at the next few chapters, we see what Jesus means by be prepared. And what we see is be prepared for judgment. What comes up in the next few chapters is the parable of the bridesmaids who are waiting for the party to start. Some of them have lamps, some of them don't. The ones who aren't ready and go home, they miss the party. We see the story of the parable of the talents, where the master comes back and says, hey, how did you invest all of these great things I gave you? And some of them have invested really well and get judged positively, and some of them have not done well and get judged negatively. So what's happening over the next few chapters is Jesus is telling us how to be ready for the end of the world, and the way that we are told to be ready is to be ready to be judged. This series of passages culminates in the story of the sheep and the goats, where everyone is sorted into either those on the right side or those on the not so good side. So the message from what Jesus is saying here is we need to be ready for Jesus' coming, which means we need to be ready to be judged. And there is precisely one way to be ready to be judged, which is to be standing with Jesus. There is no way to be ready to be judged aside from being able to point to Jesus and say, he's already paid what I owe. There is no other way. If you've come out of this passage feeling a bit worried, the only way to be ready for the end is to be with Jesus. And the good news is, if you believe in Jesus, you are already there. So God is not in the temple. He is too big for that. And preparing for the end means preparing for judgment, which means being found in Jesus. Which, it's church language. I couldn't find a better way to say it. But really, being found in Jesus is making sure that when God comes to say, have you paid the price for your sin? You can say, I'm with Jesus. Jesus has paid my price. And then finally, there's still a lot of standing firm to be done in the temple before it gets destroyed. This is not the first time that Jesus visits the temple. His first visit reminds us that there is still value in broken things. In Luke chapter 2, we read the story of a man called Simeon. Simeon is a righteous man, a man who follows God, and he has been told, he's been prophesied to, that he will not die until he sees the Lord's Messiah. When it was time for him to see that Messiah, the Holy Spirit leads him to the temple. This broken place that Jesus is going to declare needs to be torn down, the Holy Spirit leads him to the temple, and there at the temple, he meets Jesus as a baby. And he then prophesies over Jesus as a baby. So there is still God's work to be done in broken places. Even though the temple was no longer where God wanted to be, and even though it was this corrupt place, God still had work to do there. At the end, our leaders, our nations, our planet, our communities, and even our church will fail, but there is lots of work to do in the meantime. Well after Jesus has described the destruction of the temple, Peter and John, the disciples, go back there and they preach at this temple, which Jesus has said is going to be torn down. In Acts 3, we see them heal a lame beggar at the gate. The temple itself served as a key gathering place for believers right up until its destruction. So all of these systems that we're in, our church, our communities, our country, our leaders, they're all going to fail, but there is still God's work to be done in the meantime. Because every system is going to fail, and that's the world that God sends us to work in. Okay, so Sam, if you want to come back up, in this chapter, Jesus tells us how the world ends. Now, people have argued over how and when that will happen for thousands of years, and they'll probably argue over that for thousands of years more. But I think this morning, what we can take away from this is simply that nothing is going to last. Nothing's going to last because anything that we could build is too small for God. So my challenge to you this morning is to consider, where are you putting your hope? Are you putting your hope in Jesus with his double-edged sword for a tongue and his flashing eyes and his presence that makes you fall over? Or are you putting your hope in something which Jesus is saying is going to be taken down? A leader, a country, a community, whatever else. Nothing's going to last because it's all too small for God, but what's coming is better.